You've heard of Grammarly, and you might think it's a fancy spell check, but people on your team have been using it and loving it for years, because it does way more than you realise. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that works seamlessly across apps and websites and can write an instant first draft in a few clicks, not a few hours. When every word your team writes is clear, concise, and on brand, companies can save 19 days per employee per year. Learn what better writing can do for your company at Grammarly.com. Grammarly. Easier said, done.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets
and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take and Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
From the heart of where innovation, money, and power collide, in Silicon Valley and beyond, this is Bloomberg Technology with Emily Chang.
I'm Emily Chang in San Francisco, and this is Bloomberg Technology coming up in the next hour.
Today, the Supreme Court of the United States expressly took away a constitutional right from the American people that it had already recognized. They didn't limit it. They simply took it away.
President Biden reacting to an unprecedented moment in American history, the Supreme Court's decision to overturn Roe versus Wade. Protests erupting outside the High Court as women respond to the news and companies are responding too. We'll discuss. Plus, the co-founder of the buzzy blockchain developer Solana Labs is out with a new crypto cell phone. We'll ask him why he's dialing in to the world of mobile. And NFT NYC comes to a close. We'll take a look at the future of NFTs as trading slows down, yet NFT companies are raking in more funding and more celebrities are jumping on the bandwagon. Where's it going? We'll discuss all that and more later this hour. But first, I want to get a look at the markets with Bloomberg's Katie Greifeld. And Katie, despite what's going on in Washington, stocks rebounding for their best week in a month.
Absolutely, Emily. It was a big textbook risk-on rally today. If you look at the S&P 500 finishing the day over 3% higher. A lot of that buying came into the close. Tech performing even better than NASDAQ 100, finishing about 3.5% higher on the day. And of course, as stocks rallied, you also saw Bitcoin rally as well. Bitcoin actually breaking above 21,000. Remember, it had been glued to about $20,000 per coin, finally getting above it. All this coming again as yields rose, textbook rally. But let's look at what that meant for the volatility index, the VIX, if you will. You can see that it sort of continues to breathe a sigh of relief, edging down. It's still above its one-year average, as you can see on the chart, but still volatility markets breathing a sigh of relief as we finally see risk assets catch a bid this week. And one of the stocks that stuck out to me was Twitter, actually. It was up for its first week in four, rallying about 5.5% over the past week. A lot of those gains came today, even. You had an insider report that Twitter, it's agreed to give Elon Musk more real-time data, more user data. So maybe, Emily, this deal will finally go through one day.
All right, we shall see. Not going to predict anything on that front. Okay, Bloomberg, Katie Greifeld, thank you. Meantime, a historic day in Washington, the Supreme Court striking down the constitutional right to an abortion. For more on this decision, how we got here, and what happens next, I'm joined by Bloomberg's Greg Storr, who covers the Supreme Court for us. So, Greg, we had a feeling this was coming, baked on the leaked draft opinion from a few months ago. But talk to us about how we got here and what has actually changed from this moment forward when it comes to women's access to abortion.
Well, how we got here was in large part through three nominees by President Donald Trump, two of whom significantly shifted the court to the right compared with what it was with their predecessors. And of course, two of those vacancies happened in an election year, and Republicans were able to fill them both. Those three justices were in the majority today. They tipped the balance. They are the ones that have made this a much more conservative court than we had seen previously. One of them, Brett Brett Kavanaugh did put some limits on today's decision in a concurring opinion. We can talk about some of those. But really, this is a victory for those who supported the Trump nominees and wanted them to transform the Supreme Court.
There is some fine print here, as you mentioned, with Justice Kavanaugh and Justice Roberts. Talk to us about what we see in that fine print.
Yeah, so Chief Justice Roberts did not join the majority in saying he would overturn Roe v. Wade. He would have, he agreed with the decision to uphold the Mississippi 15-week ban, but he said the court didn't need to go beyond that in this case. Justice Kavanaugh did vote to overturn Roe, but he added a concurring opinion that laid out a few areas where he didn't think the court needed to go or shouldn't go. Among them, he said that if a state were to try to ban somebody from traveling to a state that allows abortion, Justice Kavanaugh said that, in his view, would be unconstitutional. And since he's really the fifth vote here, that would mean that the Supreme Court would not uphold that sort of travel ban. He also included some language suggesting that he felt pretty strongly the court was not deciding other things, like whether the same-sex marriage ruling from a few years ago was still good law.
How have the states been reacting to the ruling? I mean, as we understand it, this could lead to abortion becoming illegal in half of U.S. states. How quickly will that happen?
As some of those very quickly, some states have already announced where abortion is now illegal. 13 states had these so-called trigger laws that were designed to take effect as soon as the court said Roe is overturned, which it did do today. There are some other states that had pre-existing bans, and there might still be some litigation as to whether those pre-existing bans can be enforced. But those 26 or so states, in pretty short order, folks are expecting them to largely ban abortion.
All right, Greg Storr, much to continue to cover here in Washington for us. Thank you, Greg. Now, we've seen numerous companies, including some of the biggest names in tech, react to this Supreme Court ruling by saying they'll provide travel benefits for employees to access abortion. But my next guest says that's not all tech companies can do to help women who want the option to navigate a post-Roe world. Joining me now is Rebecca Wexler. She is an assistant professor of law at Berkeley Center for Law and Technology. So first of all, Rebecca, you say that big tech companies can take a stand, and not necessarily in the way we might think. What can big companies do in this debate?
Absolutely. Well, they have to take a stand. There is no neutral position. They have an either-or choice. They can either protect pregnant people who are seeking medical care, or they can help anti-abortion prosecutions. And there's a couple different ways they can do this. One is they have a choice about what kind of information they will aid in disseminating to people who are pregnant and seeking access to medical care. So how do you access medication abortion? How do you access abortion clinics across state lines that remain open and functioning? Tech companies could choose to provide that information, provide free security services to websites disseminating that information so they're protected from vigilante hackers, or they could choose to use their content moderation policies to shut that information down and censor it.
There are a bunch of other things they could do as well. Exactly. Well, let's talk about it all because, something very valuable that big tech companies have is the data. And if law enforcement asks for this data, aren't they obligated to hand it over by law?
Great question. So it depends on what law enforcement uses when they ask. If law enforcement comes and says, pretty please, no, of course they're not required to hand it over. If law enforcement comes with a valid warrant, well, then sure, a company has to comply. But actually, companies are receiving requests for data from law enforcement all the time. They have representatives that engage in negotiations around those requests, and they can choose to be more stringent, less helpful, shall I say, less providing efficient data distribution to law enforcement, they can challenge the scope of even a lawful warrant. There's something called a motion to quash. I really love the word quash. But Facebook or Meta has done this in the past with warrants, taking them to court to say this is overbroad, it's a fishing expedition, it's not sufficiently particular. And the tech companies know generally which laws are claimed to be violated when they receive a warrant. So one of the things they could do, even in that extreme where police are coming with, where anti-abortion prosecutors are coming with valid legal process, the company can also push back and assert rights to challenge that process in court. They could additionally notify the people whose information is being sought, so long as that's not prohibited by the warrant. And they could do things before they get to the warrant stage that would protect all this data that we're generating all the time from being used in anti-abortion prosecutions. So having end-to-end encryption for all your communications by default, giving warnings to users to say, if you choose this communication channel, your data is going to be subject to law enforcement surveillance. Storing data locally on users' devices instead of in the cloud, purging data, giving users the right to delete data remotely, foregoing using complex analytic systems to predict people's early pregnancies and abortions. All of these things they could be doing. They could say, we're not going to store location tracking data for people that are traveling near abortion clinics. So there is no neutral position. If they collect this data, they store it, they make it easy for law enforcement to access, that's a choice. They're aiding anti-abortion prosecutions.
Interesting. Well, we have heard from some prominent women in technology so far today. This from Melinda Gates. Today, a government in which women have never had an equal voice reached deep into the most private corners of a woman's life to tell her the choice over what she does with her body is no longer her own. This is America taking a step, a big step, backward. And this from Sheryl Sandberg. The Supreme Court's ruling jeopardizes the health and lives of millions of girls and women across the country. It threatens to undo the progress women have made in the workplace and strip women of economic power. She also points out that this will impact women the most with the fewest resources. Now, it's one thing for Sheryl Sandberg, who's the COO of Meta, and yes, she's leaving in September, to say this. It's another for Meta, the company, to take a stand. What more specifically could a company like Meta, which has all of this information about what users are talking about to each other in private messages, what more could a company like Meta specifically do in this instance to take a stand? And what are they actually likely to do, given that these companies, the data, is their business model?
Well, they absolutely could take a stand to say that data that would subject people to criminal prosecution for abortions is going to be treated differently. They have enough data on all of us to serve their business model. They don't need data about people's private health choices in order to make money. So they could cordon off data that is going to make people vulnerable to criminal prosecutions and say, we're going to protect that. We're going to treat it differently. We're going to purge it. We're going to fight when law enforcement comes to access it. They could provide those privacy protections and use their power to reclaim some of the privacy from government intrusion that Roe once guaranteed and the court just eviscerated.
Do you see a wave of warrants, a wave of lawsuits and demands for this kind of information from law enforcement to tech companies to startups?
Absolutely. The data that we are generating in our everyday lives is already being used in criminal prosecutions. Fitbit data has been used in murder prosecutions. People's unencrypted text messages, web search histories, chat messages have already been used to charge one woman who miscarried with feticide and another with murder. So the location data, the web search histories, your emails, your communications, your associations, all of those are data that law enforcement can and does use and will pursue. This conversation has focused a lot on period tracking apps, which is a hugely important issue. How are those apps that serve reproductive choice needs going to protect people, protect their users? But in fact, it's all this other kind of data that will also leave people vulnerable. Heartbeat, sleep cycle data. Any of this information can be used as evidence in court to convict people of crimes.
Interesting. All right. Rebecca Wexler, Assistant Professor of Law at Berkeley. Professor Wexler, thank you for joining us. As we were talking, we got a headline from The Washington Post that Google workers can now apply to relocate in the aftermath of this decision to overturn Roe versus Wade, that coming from the chief people officer at Google to employees. We'll continue to cover more headlines as we get them. More still to come. This is Bloomberg.
What if everyone at work were an expert communicator? What if every doc, message, and email they wrote was perfectly clear and concise? Inbox numbers would drop, customer satisfaction scores would rise, and everyone would be more productive. That's where Grammarly comes in. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that understands your business and can transform it through better communication. Companies that use Grammarly save an average of 19 days per employee per year. That's because with Grammarly's AI, what used to take a few hours only takes a few clicks. Like generating an instant first draft in your company voice or tailoring a message to your specific audience and goals. And Grammarly's personalized on-brand writing help is built in everywhere your team works, across 500,000 apps and websites. Plus, it's safe, secure, and already IT approved. Join 70,000 teams who trust Grammarly with their words and their data. Learn more at Grammarly.com. Grammarly, easier said, done.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's Stifel.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
Shares of Twitter rose to end the week. This after Twitter said it sent more user data to Elon Musk, including real-time information, which could allow the Musk team to determine how many users are actually bots, which, of course, Musk has been complaining about. Last week, Musk's lawyers sent Twitter a letter complaining the data wasn't enough that they had sent previously. And hackers have stolen $100 million in an attack on a cryptocurrency Bridge, an app that lets people swap coins between blockchains. Harmony says it's working with national authorities and forensic specialists to identify the hackers and get the money back. So-called crypto bridges have been seen as particularly vulnerable to hacks. The The saga begins. That is how Solana is building its newest venture, mobile phones. The blockchain is unveiling a crypto phone for Android called Saga, along with the Solana mobile stack and open source software toolkit, also for Android. Joining me now, Solana Labs co-founder Anatoly Yakovenko. Anatoly, thank you so much for joining us. So how does launching a mobile phone fit into Solana's broader ambition of being a pivotal key NFT blockchain?
Thank you for having me, first of all. It's awesome to be here. So phones are the everyday device that you use. You know, everybody has one. You probably spend more time on your phone than on anything else. And the most important part about crypto and these networks is self-custody. And it's a really complicated piece because it involves cryptography. So not a lot of people understand it. Not a lot of people actually use wallets like Phantom, like MetaMask around the world. And the goal with the phone is to make that experience delightful and easy and simple and have the user experience of like Google Pay or something like that.
You actually had a career in mobile back at Qualcomm.
Yeah.
How long have you been thinking about a crypto mobile phone?
As soon as we started working on Solana, we kind of felt that, imagine everybody in the world using these networks. Of course, they're going to use them from their phones. And because it involves secrets and cryptography, given that it worked a lot on the hardware layer, the firmware layer, it's kind of obvious to build all of these smarts directly into the device itself. So kind of having your hardware wallet be your phone just makes a lot of sense.
Now, Solana has gotten a lot of buzz over the last couple of years. More broadly, what is it about Solana that you think makes it better than other blockchains?
It's cheaper and faster. That's about it. And that means that developers building Web3 applications can build them for a larger number of people, make it more delightful, simpler, and easier to use. And that has translated into growth everywhere, but holy moly, NFTs. There's nearly 15 million NFTs minted on Solana. That's not something any one of us expected, but it's kind of crazy to watch.
Now, Helium has also been trying to do something similar with wireless for years, but they're just now starting a 5G pilot. They have a deal with Dish. What does Solana think it can do better here? Are you looking for corporate wireless deals along those lines?
I would love to take a Helium 5G SIM card and plug it into Saga. That would be amazing. That means this is a crypto phone running on a decentralized 5G network.
So, Solana has been focused on more kind of fintech applications. Why throw wireless into the mix?
I think the key part to adoption is making that experience of cryptography simpler for users. It's just such a complicated thing. And one of the biggest challenges is even for web developers, like Web3 developers. They can't build true Web3 applications for the big app stores. So part of the Solana mobile stack is a developer-friendly app store that doesn't have extractive fees. And that's a huge selling point for a lot of devs.
Solana has been having issues with congestion. Won't this additional usage make that worse?
So congestion issues that we have on the network come from bots, not really from humans. And a lot of the performance improvements in 1.10 are already showing that a lot of the bugs have been fixed. Every release just makes the network better and better.
What else are you doing to fix the reliability issues?
There's three technologies that are rolling out. So they're already implemented in 1.10, and 1.10 is already in mainnet, but they're not activated by the community yet. And that's going to take over the next several months. And that's Quick, stake-weighted QoS, and most importantly, localized fee markets. So if you heard of Ethereum and how there's an airdrop and all of a sudden transactions are costing $1,000, that's something that can be contained within an application. So when there's something popular happening in one airdrop, that doesn't impact Solana Pay, for example.
Now, the crypto market is going through this broader crypto winter, and I'm so curious what your take is on that and whether you think this skepticism around digital currencies will bleed into the blockchain market.
Yeah, I think what's been really surprising is that the users that are engaging on platforms like Magic Eden haven't slowed down. The amount of engagement they're having, how often they're participating in mints, and how many of them are doing it, that just keeps growing and growing. So I think we're, for the first time, seeing web experiences that are totally decoupled from the price of Bitcoin. And I think the big deal here is that these are new business models. You know, Magic Eden does not make money off an ad exchange somewhere. It's a purely Web3 application running on Web3 digital assets.
Now, there's a more existential question at play here. We're seeing, you know, venture capitalists that have plowed money into blockchain technology, big backers of Solana. I wonder how you square that with this, you know, ethos of decentralization.
So I think what actually drives decentralization is users that use the network and love it and need to run the actual physical hardware because they're getting some value out of it. And because of that, we've seen the number of nodes in the network breach over half of what Ethereum has today. So roughly 3,400 on Solana, and I think roughly about 6,000 on Ethereum. So, you know, kind of roughly, if you think of it in these terms, Solana is as half as decentralized as Ethereum, but one of the top three networks at this point.
Any concerns about DYDX competing with Solana?
So I think DYDX moved from Starkware to a Cosmos chain. I mean, I love Cosmos. Zaki is an amazing builder. I love that whole community. I think that's a perfectly great spot for them for the kind of application they're building.
All right. We'll keep watching. Solana co-founder cool. Anatoly Yakovenko, thank you for joining
thank
us.
Thank you.
The health and life of women in this nation are now at risk.
The voiceless will finally have a voice.
The termination of a pregnancy is just their opening act. It's just their front game.
I don't know what the limits of this court are going to be.
All civil rights are under threat.
It will save the lives of millions of children, and it will give families hope.
It will have huge implications, economic implications for families. It
takes away their ability to engage fully in the economy.
This decision is not about abortion. It is about power and patriarchal control over women.
It pushes it back to state legislatures all across the country.
You will see certainly a little bit more voter intensity even in swing states and Senate races this fall.
A woman's right to choose, reproductive freedom, is on the ballot in November.
Welcome back to Bloomberg Technology. I'm Emily Chang in San Francisco. I want to get back to today's big story, the Supreme Court overturning Roe versus Wade, wiping out American women's constitutional right to abortion, a ruling that's likely to make the procedure illegal in half the country. I want to talk about the role of telehealth here and how health tech companies can maybe bridge that gap for women who want that choice. My next guest is the co-founder and CEO of Hey Jane, an at-home abortion pill company, Kiki Friedman. Kiki, thank you so much for joining us. As someone who runs an at-home abortion pill company, what is your reaction to this ruling?
We think the Supreme Court today was absolutely on the wrong side of history. By overturning Roe, these judges are making an incredible attack on people's individual liberty, and they are putting the health of millions of individuals at risk. The decision is coming at a time when the vast majority of Americans do support access to safe and legal abortion care. And, you know, I do think it's important to note that abortion is still legal in many states in this country, despite what we've seen as a lot of confusion around the issue, and that unlike in the pre-Roe era, today we do have access to safe, effective abortion pills and the technology to connect with patients to give them the support that they need.
So how does this decision impact your business model? Are there changes that you're having to make right now as a result of this law?
We will continue operating in all six states in which we're currently live. Abortion does remain legal in those states. We've strategically positioned ourselves in those states as the locations that are likely to absorb the most demand after Roe. Forecasts are suggesting, for example, a 3,000% increase in out-of-state travelers seeking abortion care in California. That number is nearly 9,000% in Illinois. We have grown our team to anticipate that increase in demand, and we also plan on launching a new state soon.
So how do you then protect your customers and your employees from being potentially liable, depending on where they're coming from?
Hey Jane is compliant with all local telemedicine laws. Our patients must be in the state where it's legal in order to receive care, and we follow all of the other very nuanced abortion and telemedicine laws within these states.
What do you see as the future for telemedicine around abortion-related issues? I mean, I imagine there's going to be a big shift, perhaps a whole economy developing around this as a result.
Yeah, we did see that this year for the first time, medication abortion was over half of all abortion treatments in this country. For some context, the medications have been around since 2000, very well studied to be incredibly safe and effective. They have a lower adverse reaction rate actually than Tylenol. We do think that medication abortion and telemedicine abortion in particular will become an increasingly important means of access as clinics become increasingly burdened by the restrictions post-Roe. It does have a number of important benefits. It can reduce the cost, the travel time, the time waited for treatment. And so it is likely to be an increasingly important part of the access landscape moving forward.
Now, this decision is likely to impact poor women disproportionately. The Hey Jane option is cheaper than a medical abortion. Pill is still a couple hundred bucks. How do you plan to make that available or help poorer women who want access to it?
Absolutely. Financial accessibility is paramount to our mission to serving the patients that we need to be serving. Our price, as you mentioned, is $249, which is less than half of the national average of $550, however, still out of reach for many. So we do partner with some really wonderful nonprofits called abortion funds that offer financial assistance to patients who need it. We're also in the process of working on insurance coverage. There is some policy work that needs to be done there in order for it to be compatible with a Medicaid model, but we're pushing forward on those changes as quickly as we can.
Now, I know you just raised $3.6 million from investors. Do you think that more investors are going to be interested, more or less interested now that we've had this decision? I mean, have you heard from investors? Are you getting fresh inbound interest?
We definitely have seen a spike in interest. I think many people living today have only lived in a post-Roe era, and the idea that this fundamental right was truly going to be stripped away felt a bit far-fetched. I think that now that people are coming to terms with the very stark reality we're facing, there is a lot more interest in assisting with solving this really critical problem.
We've been getting headlines from how tech companies are and are not taking a stand about this. Google, according to the Washington Post, just told workers they can apply for relocation as a result of the Roe decision. Meta telling workers not to talk about the decision openly, that according to the New York Times. What stand do you think big tech companies that have access to a lot of data and a lot of power, what should they be doing?
That's a great question. I think the number one thing they absolutely must be doing is protecting access for their employees. We have seen many large companies step up to support funding for cross-state travel when needed. I think that's absolutely essential. I think there's also a lot of concerning trends happening with the use of data to track abortion patients and providers. And to the extent that these companies can mitigate those risks, I think they certainly have a moral obligation to do so.
All right, Kiki Friedman, Hey Jane, co-founder and CEO, thank you for joining us and sharing your perspective. We'll be right back with more of Bloomberg Technology after this break.
What if everyone at work were an expert communicator? What if every doc, message, and email they wrote was perfectly clear and concise? Inbox numbers would drop, customer satisfaction scores would rise, and everyone would be more productive. That's where Grammarly comes in. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that understands your business and can transform it through better communication. Companies that use Grammarly save an average of 19 days per employee per year. That's because with Grammarly's AI, what used to take a few hours only takes a few clicks, like generating an instant first draft in your company voice or tailoring a message to your specific audience and goals. And Grammarly's personalized on-brand writing help is built in everywhere your team works, across 500,000 apps and websites. Plus, it's safe, secure, and already IT approved. Join 70,000 teams who trust Grammarly with their words and their data. Learn more at Grammarly.com. Grammarly, easier said, done.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel has become one of the fastest-growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle-market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take and Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Time now for our crypto report, and I want to take a look at the week that was with our crypto contributor, Shanali Basak. And it looked like, Shanali, didn't end up being too bad a week for crypto this week, did it?
Yeah, finally, we have some green on the screen for the crypto crowd. We have about a 3.5% jump in Bitcoin over the seven-day period, and an even bigger jump, Emily, when you look at Ethereum. You're looking at a 12% jump over 7 days, a more than 8% jump over the last 24 hours. And again, that brings you above 21,000 for Bitcoin safely for now, and above 1,200 for Ethereum, for which a lot of NFTs are based on. I do want to bring you another chart here, and we're going to talk about this a lot with our next guest, because one area of excitement is NBA Top Shot volumes. And if you look at NFT trading volumes, you do see them slowing down. The same had been true for Top Shot, but there is a lot of excitement about the application of NFTs, especially as it relates to other industries, primarily sports. We talked about videos yesterday. Let's see how much that can keep going on, especially as this big conference in New York this week starts to wind down.
All right, Shanali, thank you. Speaking of NFTs, NFT NYC coming to a close, Web3 and NFT enthusiasts spent the week discussing the opportunities and challenges ahead, including, for instance, the crypto market and NFT trading volume sinking. And yet there are some still placing big, big bets on NFT marketplaces. My next guest is the CEO of Dapper Labs, a popular NFT marketplace behind CryptoKitties and NBA Top Shot, Roham Gary Goslow with us now, along with Shanali. So, Roham, why are you still bullish on NFTs given the decline in trading volumes?
Well, you know, this is not our first market cycle, and we're bullish on NFTs because we think, you know, it's crypto and NFTs in particular is one of the only areas in tech that, you know, we've touched about a million NBA fans. There's a billion NBA fans out there. There's a 1,000x growth potential in the market just by building products that people want to use. And NFTs, to me, stand for open digital assets, assets that, you know, people are already spending $100 billion a year in digital worlds. The NFT technology lets those assets be portable, lets developers build new kinds of experiences on them. And the technology for that is just now getting to the point of maturity where, you know, it's good user experience, it's low cost, and it's scalability with blockchains like Flow and others helping make NBA Top Shot successful. So we've taken everything that's powered NBA Top Shot and recently crossed $1.2 billion in transaction volume there, and making it available to companies all around the world, from startups to Fortune 500. So some of the world's smartest folks are building in this ecosystem that for most of us is, you know, for most people out there is a year and a half, 2 years old. And I'm super excited to see, you know, the value that's going to be created over the next little while.
And some of the biggest athletes and celebrities are getting in on it or trying to. You just announced a new partnership with Magic Johnson. Tell us about that and the role that celebrities and athletes will play here.
Well, I think NFTs, Web3 in particular, is just a way for communities to come together and for celebrities or brands to connect with their fans in new ways. So Magic really got this in a way that I haven't seen many folks get it immediately. And he jumped in. He's created a line of NFTs on NBA Top Shot, some of his greatest moments, some of the greatest moments from his history. And he's also put his annotations and his commentary over these moments, and the fans have been going crazy. So it's really exciting to see that, and it's exciting to see NBA Top Shot become kind of a hub for if athletes want to engage with their fans, that's where they start, because that's where the fans already are. And then the next interesting thing that we've got coming up is the launch of NFL All Day with the new NFL season. So we're excited to talk about that.
Yeah,
as well.
I wanted to ask you more about other sports on top of the NBA. The NBA has done so much in the NFT world already, but how much adoption do you think could expand into the NFL and other sports? What's on the horizon?
So Dapper Labs, we're working on NFL All Day and UFC Strike. NFL All Day should launch by the beginning of the season. And if folks are in LA, get excited for some real-world benefits and real-world integration between kind of the NFT economy and then showing up to the season opener and things like that.
But what does that look like? Because on one hand, you do have this virtual world and huge communities being formed online. But at what point does the rubber hit the road in the real world when you are going to sports games?
Well, I think it goes two ways. One is people that are going to live games, they're going to be earning free kinds of NFTs. We call them flow attendance tokens or proof of attendance tokens. And people will even be able to earn different kinds of those for dialing into broadcast games and being essentially an engaged fan. And that sort of bridges, that's one way to bridge the physical world into the digital world, give folks something to do with their kids and friends as they watch the live game, give some value back to folks that show up to the arena. And then on the other hand, we want to take our best collectors, folks that have spent tens of thousands, in some cases hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars on inside the economies of these various teams and leagues, and show that data to the teams and the teams themselves. They want to provide special experiences for those folks. This is a younger generation, folks that, you know, they might have season tickets, but they might want to engage in the sport in different ways. They'd rather, you know, have $1 million NBA have $1 million in LeBron moments than a courtside seat. But still, when they show up to a game, they expect to be treated differently, and this technology allows that because it's open and the data is visible for anyone to be able to build on top of.
I love the Warriors, Roham, but we're baseball fans. My kids play baseball. What about baseball? I mean, FTX is on the uniform of every umpire in Major League Baseball.
Yeah, I mean, so Dapper Labs doesn't work directly with baseball, but we have a number of other companies that are building interesting products. And like I said, we've opened up our tools, so whether it's the Flow blockchain or the Dapper wallet on top, so that you'll probably see other companies using our tools to build their products on top. So you can use the same credit card you have loaded up for NBA Top Shot to transact in any number of other marketplaces and virtual worlds.
Emily was just talking to the co-founder of Solana. We had Magic Eden on earlier in the week. There was a lot of conversation about shifting away from just Ethereum into Solana NFTs. How much are you seeing the NFT community float into other chains? Do you think that move is going to be more aggressive?
I think so. I mean, in a lot of ways, but it's new communities also being created. The community on Ethereum is incredibly strong. There's only 20,000 transactions in the last 24 hours because it's expensive to transact on Ethereum. So you end up seeing a lot of expensive, high-value assets being transferred, whereas on Flow, it costs fractions of a cent. You can sell something for a dollar, and that is just much more accessible, much more engaging to folks, and same thing on Solana, very low cost, high volume. And that enables new kinds of user experiences. You know, the world that we believe will exist is certain things will happen on different networks, just like today on the internet. You have, you know, Microsoft Azure as well as Amazon Web Services. You have EC2 and S3 and all of these, and it's the developer's job to build on top of them in a way that makes it simple for the user. And so we've built Flow as a computation chain, and it provides a certain a level of both low cost, environmental friendliness. It's by far the most environmental friendly blockchain. But at the same time, in NBA Top Shot, you can still still spend Bitcoin. You can spend Ethereum because those are great payment networks. And so we think that this kind of specialization will accelerate in the so-called crypto winter. But more and more users, there's 1,000x growth potential in this industry, and that's very different. And so that's what we're focused on.
Okay, let's talk about the winter. I know you've been through downturns before. How are you evaluating this one in particular and what's different about it and how crypto survives it?
I mean, I have no doubt crypto has been through multiple downturns. I mean, you guys know that as well. And like I said, it's the only area in tech, one of the only areas where there's a direct 1,000x increase in terms of the market size that we as software developers can accelerate just by building products that people use that add value back to fans and that make it easier and easier to build on top of this technology, which is still quite challenging in many ways. So, you know, what is different about this downturn? It's a generalized downturn rather than, the last couple of crypto winters, which were sort of specific to crypto. But at the same time, we've seen in previous recessions, people's mentality changes, but they still want to engage in entertainment. They still want to engage in sports and gaming. They just want to get more value for their time with their kids. They're going to get more value for the money they're spending as fans. And NFTs and crypto is all about giving value back to the fan, giving value back to the user. Because if you spend a dollar in a digital world that's not crypto enabled, you're never going to get that dollar back. If you spend a dollar on an NFT, it keeps giving back to you. And at the end of the day, it's liquid. You can transfer it. You can keep it forever. Or you can give it to your kids, whatever it might be. And the ecosystem we're working on with our league partners at the NBA, NFL, UFC, is to say, well, look, let this be the backbone of a loyalty experience for each of those sports. And in an environment of crypto, an environment of generalized downturn, let's give back to the fan. Let's make sports an excitement, an entertaining activity that they can engage in both in a digital and physical world.
Fascinating. Roham Garigaslow, CEO of Dapper Labs and Bloomberg's own Shanali Bosick, thank you. We'll keep watching. The NSA, one of America's most secretive spy agencies, is running a summer camp for teenagers, many of them across the country. Our reporter Katrina Manson joined one of those camps and is back to tell the tale. Katrina, what happens at an NSA summer camp?
My goodness. I mean, they say they're trying to teach kids cybersecurity and encourage the leaders of tomorrow to come and join cybersecurity jobs. The Biden administration sees a 500,000 shortfall in cybersecurity workers. And this, the NSA says, is all to ignite interest in that at an early enough age that you can change their choices, encourage them to become cybersecurity professionals. What happens? My goodness, I saw kids programming drones. They were talking coding. I know that they had plans for a Jeopardy game, a quiz at the end of the week, and they were handing out Gen Cyber dollars. These are fake money to encourage the kids to stay glued. And they tried to do everything from keep lectures short, just to 10 minutes, and there was a steady supply of snacks all day.
So are they teaching kids to spy?
They would say not. The NSA says this is all about cybersecurity, encouraging especially young women and underrepresented minorities to think about these careers, and also boost cyber safety for teens who might be susceptible or vulnerable to cyber bullying, cyber stalking, those sorts of issues, to equip them for this modern age. Having said that, although it's not a direct recruitment line, kids who have taken this have gone on to join the NSA, DOD, US Air Force, and to cyber security jobs in the commercial world. They also have changed some of the requirements. The NSA doesn't actually teach these courses themselves. Institutions apply for funding, but they have to hit certain guidelines. One of those is to make sure they're teaching the kids to, quote unquote, think like an adversary. They also teach hacking. Ethical hacking, they would say, and they do discuss ethics. When I spoke to ethics teachers, I don't think they were discussing ethical issues at the NSA, behind the NSA, and of course, there is that 2013 Edward Snowden case whose implications keep coming, which raised huge revelations, questions about the extent of the NSA's surveillance techniques. And I think it's fair to see this outreach as part of the NSA, which insiders used to call no such agency, never say anything, part of their come out, part of them coming out into the public eye and becoming more public facing since 2014.
Interesting. Well, you wonder when they're going to start doing summer camps for adults, given those 600,000 open jobs. But what a fascinating.
They'll be away.
Bloomberg's Katrina Manson. Well, you've already done some time. Thank you so much for bringing us that story. That does it for this edition of Bloomberg Technology. Wall Street Week with my colleague David Westin coming up next. Larry Summers is with him, who called the Supreme Court's decision today appalling. That's next. This is Bloomberg.
Join us in Chicago or virtually on May 2nd for Bloomberg's Business Value of AI event and networking reception. This event will gather business and technology executives to share their experiences and provide insights into their strategies for deploying AI that achieves a desirable ROI. You'll also learn how companies have successfully implemented AI solutions that have improved productivity and profitability. This program is proudly sponsored by IBM. Register at BloombergLive.com/AI/radio.